Talking about money is hard. People all over the world were taught never to talk about money, politics, sex, or religion in polite company. But on this show, my goal is to remove money from that list. And so I'm excited to bring you 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning from Blind Nil Audio and executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. Follow and listen to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning with me, Carl Richards, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Market Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell.
Welcome back to the Market Musings podcast, and today our guest is the CEO and founder of AEX Gold, Eldur Ólafsson. Hi, Eldur. Welcome onto the Market Musings podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, and thanks for having me.
No, it's a pleasure to have you. And where are you calling us from today?
I sit in an office in Iceland. I'm an Icelandic individual, and as maybe some of your listener might know, then Iceland is very close to Greenland. It's a little next door, so it's very conveniently located if you're working in Greenland.
Indeed. And is it true that the rumor with Iceland is it was called Iceland to deter people from going there, and Greenland was called Greenland because they wanted to attract people there? Is that rumor true?
Yeah, I mean, well, true or not true, at least that was written by our forefathers and Vikings. And to some extent, I think there was a second or the third Viking that came up here to Iceland. He lost his ship and his family, I believe, and therefore he kind of put that name on the country. Even at that point in time when he was coming over, there was forest between the sea and the mountain, and the glacier were much, much smaller than they are today. But it was Eric Red who gave Greenland this name to do exactly that. It was all part of marketing, right?
Yeah, very clever. Well, I've been to Iceland myself, as I was saying before the podcast. It's a lovely, lovely place full of natural wonders. I'd recommend people to go there. There's so much to see, so many interesting things going on. And of course, Kenny, you're joining us as well from another natural, wondrous place of the earth, Scotland.
Yep. And I actually think Scotland is as cold as Iceland today. It is absolutely freezing. It's only about, 0 degrees, but it's the wind is just dragging it down, and it feels like, -7, -8, which is, the Scottish cold seems to be very penetrating, so it does. But no, I'd love to go to Iceland, Eldur, because I spoke before, I'm a big salmon fisher, so yeah, there's not many salmon left in the west coast of Scotland, so I'm going to have to start spreading my wings and look for some rich fishing grounds, and I believe Greenland and Iceland have got plenty of these.
Yeah, absolutely. At least in relation to salmon, Iceland has a lot, and Greenland is more Arctic char, but there seems to be some. There's a lot of salmon in the fjords there, but maybe less so that go up the rivers there. So, no, it's a very good place to do that. Sure.
Definitely. But no, it's great to have you on the podcast, Eldur. And what we like to do in the Market Musings is, companies can have the best projects in the world, but if you don't have the right people to manage these projects, then it's just never going to succeed. So we like to get the directors and the CEOs, the chairman on, and just sort of strip them back and almost get like a potted history of, what their career was, their successes, their failures, where they grew up, what their education was like, who inspired them, and what drives them in business. So really, it's an opportunity for you, Eldur, just maybe for the next 10, 15 minutes, just to take us back as far as you want and tell us a bit about yourself and ultimately your journey to AEX Gold. And then Once we've covered that, we'll talk about AEX Gold as well. So, yep, there's plenty of time. So if it takes 20 minutes, myself and Mark are all ears, and we'll jump in with questions as and when.
No, definitely. That sounds amazing. So I mean, it's if you're happy for me to go ahead, I'll start going on. I like very much talking about myself, so you might sit there for 25. So I'm born and raised in Iceland. I very much come from a family of that kind of a work with their hands, so to say. I like to look at the world today where you have people who work with their hands and then people who do software companies and so on. But we were very much in the working with your hands. So we had 400 sheep, we had horses and land to maintain and manage. And as you can imagine, farming in Iceland is not easy. Short seasons and there's a lot of work that needs to happen. But in my childhood, my family also had a separate calling, so to say, is that they ran a home for children who were in difficulties in their lives. So kind of to relate to that, some of these children maybe had instances at their home where their parents couldn't take care of them, or they had issues with drugs, or even something even more worse than that. So during my whole childhood, I was brought up with six children at any point given in time, who were kind of basically became my foster siblings. So I had this kind of a really lovely childhood in the countryside of Iceland, working, riding horses, herding sheep, feeding the livestock, taking the hay, as such. So that's a very kind of a simple background of how I kind of grew up until I was 16 here in Iceland. But like, I'm a geologist, and people often ask me, like, why did you become a geologist? What got you interested in geology? And here in Iceland, again, back to sheep, because I think in Scotland and in England, everything is related to sheep farming or somehow related to that. And it's the same thing as in Iceland. But we had to herd the sheep in Iceland up, or in our, as I should say, community, we had to herd them up to the mountains up in Iceland. So essentially up until the middle of Iceland. And every fall we had to go up there with two horses, and you would herd them back for 7 days. And you would essentially sleep in these huts, which was more like a, you probably not offer it to anyone who would be traveling in Iceland today. And those experiences, you were essentially riding around in complete wilderness, up in around glaciers, glacial rivers, big mountains, volcanoes, and looking for sheep. I did that first when I was 12, becoming to be 13. And the test to be able to do that was almost like a manhood test in my community. I had to lift a lamb up on my horse. This is easier in Iceland because the horses in Iceland are, I wouldn't call them ponies, but they're not very tall as you would find them in England or in Scotland. And we would essentially do that over a week. And you became one of the essentially farmers in the village, and you became essentially adult very young on, or in a young age. And that brought me to geology, because you're surrounded with nature, and you're surrounded with these big structures and these things. So that brought me to do, like, when people ask me why did you become a geologist, that was exactly it. Extremely fond memories of my kind of a childhood and how I was privileged getting the upbringing that essentially gave me the purpose for what I do today. That it's not only about essentially dollars on your bank account, it's actually also about making a difference in what you do. And that's what I very much learned in my upbringing, where my mom and dad were kind of doing, well, we had 200 children that went through our home. So, and 80% of them are doing really well today. So it's a very privileged way of being brought up, I find.
Mm-hmm. What a fantastic place to learn geology as well. There's so many things going on, isn't there, over in Iceland?
So in Iceland, what is the beauty of Iceland is that, you can, in 3 hours, you can see geysers, glaciers, volcanoes, just within that 3 hours, right? I mean, if you're going to do that in other countries, you wouldn't be able to do that unless you travel, like, with flight 8 hours between different areas. So that's a privilege. And as such, the geological department in the University of Iceland is extremely strong and has a lot of interaction with geological departments all around the world, being schools in England or in France or in Europe or in the US. So that was a particular interest to us. And what I did in the beginning, I'm not sure if you know this, but Iceland is quite well known for its use of geothermal power in the country. So I kind of, my emphasis is in my study was focused on that. For those who don't know, but geothermal is essentially, I think 60% of the energy we use in Iceland, total energy, comes from geothermal. And to put that into perspective, geothermal is essentially extracted in a way that we drill oil wells, essentially, they're the same design as oil wells, into a volcano and down to 2 to 3 kilometers depth. And we extract heat from that area in form of either steam or water. And from that holes, we generate electricity from the steam, and from the hot water, we generate water to heat our houses. And to put this in layman terms, in Iceland today, we generate about almost 1,000 megawatts of electricity from geothermal. And the equivalent of 1,000 megawatts of electricity would be needed to heat up Reykjavik city, but we actually are using the wastewater from these holes. Just we pump that water to Reykjavik. And I think per capita, we have the most swimming pools you can find in the world because there's so much hot water. It makes it livable here in Iceland. And how we've extracted it, because we don't have never had any oil and gas or anything like that. And therefore, for us, we are saving about a $1 billion a year in not importing in oil and gas to Iceland for the purposes of heating and electricity.
Indeed. The side effect is the sort of slight sulfur smell, isn't it? Sometimes when you take a shower, you can pick that up.
It sure can. And I think many people find, I think you worded it very politely. You call it sulfur smell. I think people relate that smell to something else, to be absolutely honest. but yes, you're right. And actually, the funny thing is, I do believe that in at least in some part of Reykjavik, you wouldn't necessarily have to have this sulfur smell because the water that is being pumped to Reykjavik is essentially heated cold water. So we use some of the hot water to heat up another water, but they actually inject a little bit of sulfur in it to kill oxygen. And if you have oxygen in the pipes, they obviously corrode. So it's actually something we could probably get away with having, but we're so used to it. So people are okay with this. I hope we smell okay, though. I'm sorry about that.
No, yeah, you smell fine. I think Iceland's maybe one of the places in the world where when you're drilling and you know sort of oil, but when you hit water, actually that's a huge bonus. But wasn't there a story that a landowner was convinced there was a thermal spring under his land, I think, and he drilled it and basically hit oil, or you know, hit steam, and built, I think, a little really small kind of geothermal power plant, and it kind of really set him up for life. I think that's a story, isn't it?
No, exactly. I mean, I can give you an example because my background obviously is, my first company I built was a geothermal company. But I think my hardest project that I've ever ran is that 3 years ago, my mom and dad, they have a geothermal hole on their farm, which about 4 other farms use. And they were getting a little bit congested. So they wanted to see if they wanted to find another hole. So eventually I mapped out where they should drill, and we did all sorts of projects. And every single day they would call me, when are we going to hit the geothermal? And we drilled down to 1,000 meters, and we got about 140 degree hot water from that hole. So it was extremely powerful. So you can find these things in the right places in Iceland.
So that was one of your first jobs then, was it?
No. It was after me drilling thousands of wells it was actually just last year, but it was still hard when you're doing something for your mom and dad and they're putting their life savings in it. So just to come back, like I finished a geological degree in Iceland. Only about 6 people finish geology every year. It's quite difficult to kind of get in and finish it. Well, not necessarily to get in, but there's not many people kind of who finish those things. And most of these individuals, they go into academic with an academic focus because there's so much to focus on. But I did a focus on extraction of geothermal fluid in the roots of geothermal system, or essentially in very close to the actually magma. So looking at drilling very, very deep in the crust. With that thesis, I landed my first job in an investment firm back in 2008 in Iceland called Geysir Green Energy. So Geysir, like something that is blowing up. And Geysir was the first company in Iceland, and this was obviously pre-crash in Iceland, financial collapse in Iceland, before the financial crisis came on. But it was the first company that invested in a portfolio of projects all around the world in geothermal, so using the Icelandic know-how and extrapolated it in the rest of the world. And there is so much geothermal in the world untapped. I mean, massive amount. So if you think about Ring of Fire, if you think about anywhere you have volcanic activity, you essentially have potential for geothermal potential. And the same thing goes with systems in geothermal where oil has been explored for. So when you go to a deep enough zones, so say in Central Europe or in China and elsewhere, you can find geothermal at 3 kilometer depth of maybe 60 to 80 degree hot water. But to essentially make a long story short, I started that role, a team of eight, where we started acquiring and building geothermal power plants all around the world. And my role was in the US, in South America, and New Zealand, name it, essentially all over. It's a very ambitious plan. But quickly, what happened was I was moved to China to work on a very small project there in a city called Shenyang in China, which is very close to Xi'an, where the terracottas are. Mm-hmm. And that project was essentially a small city that was being hit. Well, I say a small city, nothing is really small in China, but a relatively small city in China terms. That was essentially, we were drilling down into old oil fields where there was a knowledge of geothermal heating or geothermal water, and we were drilling down to 2 to 3 kilometers depth and pumping that hot water from the hole and replacing that hot water with essentially coal or gas, right? And pumping that into district heating systems in these cities in China. And this was a joint venture with Sinopec Group. Sinopec is the largest oil company in China, and state-owned oil company. And we essentially, this group was we had exclusivity all north of China to operate and build geothermal power projects with them. And when I started there, everything was in its infancy, and it had a lot of teething problem. And the main teething problem there was that you were trying to apply Icelandic know-how and technology and operatorship to a Chinese reality, right? Mm-hmm. So when I came there, we had a lot of Icelanders involved, et cetera, and then I was put in charge to kind of set things up. And part of it, yes, was geological know-how, but also I knew how to weld piping and I used to do that as my summer job. So I understood a little bit about these things as well. But when I came there, I quickly understood that having this gap between Iceland and China wasn't going to work. So we were lucky enough in Iceland, we had ran an education program for, well, United Nations, or through a United Nations geothermal training program, where we had educated about 60 people from China in geothermal development. And so what we did is that we hired them to come in, extremely smart and qualified people, and essentially ran a joint venture. So Chinese individual understood Chinese reality, but understood also what it needs to take to run proper geothermal development. And essentially, it absolutely blossomed, and it went extremely well. And we moved this venture from essentially starting in one city to three provinces and multiple cities in my time there. But while this was happening, Geysir went into administration because my company that I worked for was then, the collapse happened in Iceland, most of the shareholders went bankrupt, and the bank took that over. And this is the first time I had put so much investment and blood, sweat and tears in teaching people welding pipes and all the rest of it. So I decided to build my first company, and I basically moved away from China there and then, went to Copenhagen for a study, and I had my first child there at the same time, a girl named Ise, and essentially put together a group to acquire the Asian arm of Geisha Green Energy. And we raised about $50 million to both acquire the project and also to invest into China. And if you think about it, this was extremely difficult. This is a joint venture. It's in resources in China. It's very difficult to understand how you can actually extract capital out of China or make an exit out of China. So this all needed to be negotiated. It needed to be fundraised. And the fundraise, like we had a Raiffeisen Bank, which is a bank and a fund related to that in Austria who funded the project. So it was a big learning curve, that kind of a financial part and restructuring part, because essentially we were restructuring an entity there. And then building the project at the same time and growing the project. But luckily this all went really well. And this company now is called Sign of a Green, and it's booming. It's doing extremely well. I got the opportunity to sell out me and my partners in 2012, which we took. Mainly, there were a few reasons for that. Partly, it's because my role was almost, I don't want to say finished, but I mean, this was in good hands. The people there were growing this, et cetera, et cetera. I was a small pawn in the investment scheme that is needed, so I couldn't necessarily follow much more of capital. But we got a good exit for our own terms. And that's when, essentially in 2012, where I decided to say, okay, we've taken this out and I want to focus on something closer at home. And Greenland had then always been on my kind of a mind. So we actually went on from building something up in China to its completeness, and then have been in focused on Greenland ever since. Mm. Kind of a backstory of it.
Yeah, I was just want to take you back to sort of Iceland, if you don't mind, the Elder as well. Obviously, sort of Iceland came to the front probably for the football reasons. I think that's what kind of captured the public's imagination maybe 3 or 4 years ago, especially when they beat England, which was obviously tremendous for me. Scottish, it was like Scotland winning the World Cup. Sorry, Mark, I know you're not a football fan, but I got from that European championship, but there's a great sense of sort of community spirit in Iceland. I mean, the chant was just so simple that the whole world is copied the football chant. You know, it was just amazing, and it was an insight into a culture that perhaps quite a lot of people had, not really seen much about Icelandic people, but for some reason it just came out in football. It was brilliant. So I take it there is a really good community spirit in the whole of Iceland.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I lived most of my kind of most of my professional career, lived outside of Iceland, but I moved back in, I want to say 2016 rather than 2015, because I wanted to, I wanted my children to grow up here. I wanted them to benefit from the school system here and the free health service and various bits and pieces. There are challenges also to live in a small country like Iceland. We're only 370,000. I mean, that's just like a small town in England, right?
Yeah.
But then again, there is this kind of a community spirit, and there is pride as well to kind of a do well and try to punch above your weight. And we've grown relatively quickly in, should we say, 100 years or probably less so, from being the poorest country in Europe to be one of the, I don't like to use the word richest, but quite well off per capita.
Yeah.
And I think there is that, to your point, there is this pride of doing well and hard work. I think that's the key, because you also have to kind of acknowledge and be fair to yourself and say, you know, when you have a pool of capital that is 370,000 people, not everybody will be, you don't have as many people to choose from than, for example, England, right? So each person matters, and therefore we built up an education system or a football union that you know, gives everybody a chance. And I think with that spirit at hand, you know, you can be quite effective in communities that are maybe trotting the same path as we are trying to do.
And as you say, it is quite a small, 370,000, I think there's, I'm trying to think, in Glasgow, there's probably a million people. So yeah, it is quite a small population. And obviously the achievement you had at that European Championship was just amazing for the size of the country. So moving on from China, how did we end up in Greenland? What was the next part of the story?
Yeah, I mean, being in China, I learned, I mean, awful lot. I mean, you learn that culture. There are, like, in any single country that I worked in, and I've highlighted, obviously, China and now Greenland, but I've obviously worked in Africa. I worked in all around the world. So you get understanding of different things. But the key understanding I got from the project I worked on in China is that resources and resource projects, they take a fair bit of longer time than most companies to develop and build. Mm-hmm. And they also, there are so many stakeholders, there are so many different people, governments, various different things that you have to work with. And so Greenland, why Greenland? I think if I focus first on the things we can't change, right? There are certain things in the world and in life you can't change. And one of them, which is geology. Even though I wanted to, you can't change geology. Geology is what it is, right? And yep. When you look at Greenland, you're looking at a landmass that is half the size of Australia. It's massive.
Mm. Yeah.
It's more southerly, it's more northerly, it's more easterly, it's more westerly than Iceland itself. It goes everywhere around it, right? So when we looked at it, and I looked at it, you have, it's a country that was opened its mining code, or it's been mined there for past 100 years, don't get me wrong, but like the legislation and being kind of investable, really that didn't come in place until 2009. And since then, from 2009 up until the last cycle ended, call it 2012 or 2013, they discovered world-class deposits in every other commodity, being iron ore, zinc, rare earths, et cetera, et cetera. And it was not for the fact that there was so much data there or because the geologists were brilliant. It's so simple. It's on surface. There's no vegetation. The glacier has scrubbed the land from the top of this mountain down to the bottom of the sea. There's good access there, believe it or not. I mean, you are very close to the shoreline most of the time, so sea access and so on. And therefore, you are in an environment that hasn't been part of the mining industry for the past 200 years. I like to say sometimes, you know, Greenland, Afghanistan, and maybe Colombia are the countries that haven't been mined for the past 200 years. And I like, you know, Greenland makes sense for us as Icelanders to be in, right? So jurisdiction, geology made sense, but there's also risk in Greenland. There's also like why, like the fairest question of all is like, why hasn't this been done if people have been mining in Alaska or in Russia for such a long time? And I think that relates to operatorship. So we understood very early on, just like when I was explaining about China, how you find your people and train people, it all takes time. And being in Iceland, you know, it's not like we can go on, if something breaks on a drilling rig or something happens, that we can just go and drive to Germany and pick it up or Netherlands or whatever. Like, it is a fair bit of issue being on an island. You have to have more inventories. You have to have each employee needs to be able to be essentially an electrician, a mechanic, and something else. You need a little bit different methodology when you're building things up in a jurisdiction like Greenland. And therefore, my focus in the beginning and our focus as a team has always been about being the best operator, most professional, most in best relations to the government and the stakeholders that are there. Because if we become the best operator, the geology is not going to cheat you. And we certainly think we're in the cusp of the next super cycle in commodity. And therefore, the funding will find its way to the company that are sitting on the best acreage. But more importantly, to what you started this conversation on, is that what is the team? What is the people who are around the company. That's going to be a key, we think.
Definitely. And I'm just looking at your presentation, Elder, and obviously your tagline is creating a Greenland legacy. Can you maybe expand on that for us and, you know, tell us what the vision is for the company?
No, 100%. So, like, what often happens in, I mean, I explained it in the beginning, the mistakes we've done in China in the beginning when we tried to build an Icelandic geothermal company in China. It just never works like that, right? You have to build a Greenlandic company in Greenland. Therefore, creating something that the Greenlandic people and the Greenlandic government is proud of and wants to participate in. So that means from everything, meaning from the, like, how well we do financially, how well we pay our people. This is a pristine environment. So we need to do it in a green, ethical manner. All of these different things, but in a Greenlandic way, okay? And therefore, like, there is more agility that is needed in Greenland. There comes a time where the weathers aren't great, so you need to have some room for movement there. There is sometimes more logistical support that you need, et cetera, et cetera. But then again, you have a lot of positive as well, especially in the Greenlandic people. They can get by and get away with a lot of different things that you wouldn't find in other jurisdictions as well. So focusing on the strengths of Greenland to create the company, but with the professionality of the individual who have worked in various different jurisdictions to kind of underpin that, rather than building on, as I said, Canadian miner in Greenland or Icelandic or even Danish in Greenland. And I think that's what we're trying to achieve. And the biggest piece of that is, with Greenland, is getting the people involved. And we have already, on all sets of level in the organization, on the board, the management, obviously at site, Greenlandic people. I mean, we train geologists, mining engineers, various different drillers we trained too this year. We are in relation to the mining school of minerals in Greenland. And so all of these bits and pieces are very much important. It's to understand their culture, understand what works for them and not for someone else, and how that changes. Because you can be in a situation in various different cultures where your instinct is to shout at someone for showing you behavior that is maybe not, you're not used to in your own country, but that behavior just might mean something completely different. So what I'm trying to say is that we have to become Greenlanding and work on the terms of Greenlanding, but still take into account the international standards and be listed in two different states, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no simple answer to it, but it's that kind of a vision that we kind of holistically have to take into account.
Yeah, and I think in this day and age, I think a lot of investors are pretty conscious about where they're putting their money. So if they see a company that's aligning themselves with the culture, the locals, and the, you know, any specific rules to, you know, for that region, you know, that's a big tick in the box for them. So you describe yourself as having the first mover advantage. Can you maybe sort of, I know you kind of touched on it earlier, can you maybe sort of paint the scene in Greenland? What kind of mining activity is going on, and why you guys, you've got such a big footprint? I think it's 4,000 square kilometres from memory. You know, why you were able to assemble such a large portfolio of amazing targets, resources?
Yeah, no, certainly. So as you've seen, my career has surrounded the fact of creating something where I'm going into an industry where everybody's going out. Like, to put this into perspective, the last cycle in mining was from, I don't know, 2002, 3, 4, 5, up until 2010, 12, right? From 2012, 13, there was just essentially drought. I mean, there's been no investment in this industry since then, up until maybe last year or year before, when we've seen all of the prices of these different minerals going up. To put that into perspective, the majors in this industry, they haven't been spending on exploration whatsoever in the past 10, 15 years, or 10 years, so to say, not at all. Because what happened there in 2012 is that most of these companies focused so much on building up large inventories of metal, and they're less focused on revenue. And then that turned around completely in the wake of you know, low commodity prices for the past 10 years. So they haven't focused at all on that. So what we saw very quickly on is that we said to ourselves, well, the world still will need a lot of minerals. And we've seen that now with electrification that is happening in the world, but various different reasons. We're 8 billion people, and we're probably going to be about 10 billion people. There's just a lot more minerals that is needed to get our, to keep our life standards as they are. And what has happened is that we went in there and we acquired this mine, Nalunaq, past producing mine. We had all of this infrastructure, we had all of this knowledge, operatorship, dealings with people, et cetera, but you also had data. We bought equivalent of data for the past 30 years. That data, it costs quite a lot to attract, buy, you know, acquire this data every year to do your exploration season, et cetera, in Greenland. And therefore, for us, we started to look at that data, analyze that data, and then we start acquiring more and more land where we saw we could have the opportunity of gold and ore and or what we call today strategic minerals. Then we acquired a second company which owned the license of Vagar, and the third which owned the license of Tartar. And we bought more and more data in this sense. So when, and people were always at us saying, why are you buying more exploration? No one's giving you any value for exploration. Like this has no value back in 2012, 13, 14, 15. Whereas today, this is so much missing that most of the land in Greenland of any interest has not been completely licensed out. And you now see Anglo American and Rio Tinto, all of these, you know, governments even going into Greenland and acquiring land. But we've got it. We've already acquired it. And that's put us in that position where we've analyzed the data, we built a team, and we have a near-term cash flow development asset to kind of fund the overall overall portfolio. In time, it puts us in a unique position. And that's when we say first mover advantage and being countercyclical to the market. I like to, on this note, I think it's quite interesting. Facebook dropped in, like people, I should ask myself, why didn't you, when you sold out of China, why didn't you just buy Facebook stock, right? Like, absolutely stupid. You have made a lot of money there, right? But if you think and take into account that Facebook lost $200 billion in market cap like in days, that's equivalent to the majority of the gold majors in the world today. That $200 billion is the size of like Agnico, Kinross, all of these different majors. If you turn this around again, that normal large fund, it would own maybe 1% commodities, which of 80% of that 1% would be oil and gas, 20% would be metal. So my point is that we need this. You know, you have to take it out with your hand. You have to know it. But we need this as human beings. And there is so little investment that is going into this. So when we say first mover advantage, when the investment will come, and it will come, otherwise we can't live under in the standard we have, that there's so much capital that will need to follow this. And therefore, the companies that have the best land where the resources are on surface already with discoveries in a good jurisdiction to operate, where it is important for companies like Apple and others to know where they're sourcing the metal from and it's done in the right manner, I think Greenland will be in the forefront of where we will be extracting this mineral. And that's kind of what we mean by first mover advantage in the kind of more maybe longer answer than you would hope for.
No, you covered everything and more. And obviously, I think it'd be good for our listeners to, you know, maybe to get a high level overview of just a main. I mean, obviously, you said you've got gold targets and you've got strategic mineral targets, but maybe if you could just give us an overview of maybe the top two targets or projects in each of these commodity sectors.
No, definitely. So in gold, our development asset, which is permitted, we finalized the IFS or the feasibility of engineering for the surface and processing plant. It's essentially we're getting it ready for production. And it's the highest grade gold mine, or one of the highest grade gold mine in the world today, 18.5 gram per ton. It essentially means with these kind of mines, usually you have a very low all-in sustaining cost, which gives you good cash flow. And it has the potential to be 2 million ounces We haven't got the resources for that, but it has the potential there. And that's what we're drilling out constantly. So it's very interesting, good operator base. The second largest one is Vagar, already drilled. The highest sample there is 2,500 gram. It has more than 2 kilometers of mineralized ridge, where we're getting anywhere above 5 to 2,000 gram per ton over those 2 kilometers. And we believe we sit on some kind of a world-class deposit similar to Fort Knox in Alaska or the likes of those kind of a deposit. So that's just gold for you. But I can mention other five of something similar scale. But the difference what I'm telling you and what many other companies are doing telling you is that the discovery is already there. We are turning around and quantifying the discovery. Versus many companies who are on exploration stage, they start on doing geophysics and they tell you, oh, I got this amazing anomaly and et cetera, et cetera. And then they start drilling. It's already there. It's on surface. We're just trying to understand how big it is. Yeah. That's the excitement. Secondly, in copper, we believe we sit on a, what we call an IOCG copper belt. And we have been acquiring all of the land which covers this IOCG copper belt. What does that mean? It means something like Olympic Dam in Australia, where you have copper, niobium, zinc, molybdenum, all of these different minerals in the same deposit. And why do we believe that? Well, we have a sample of all of these minerals where you have up to 3.4% copper, 2% zinc, zircon, 90% niobium, all within the same sample, right? And it's the same geological line that goes to Arctic in Sweden, which is an IOCG mine as well. So it's a fairly straightforward what we're looking for. It takes time and it will take us time to kind of explore it and so on. We have in Nano copper gold already, 3.4% copper discovered on surface, a zone of 20 meters thick, goes underneath the glacier. I believe it continues 25 kilometers underneath the glacier, completely undrilled, but it's all on surface. We have 3 graphite exposure on surface. The biggest one in Nørrearm, where you have 5 meters thick graphite over 2 kilometers length. So that's initial samples were 14% graphite. We're now doing retesting of those. We resampled that deposit and are now trying to understand flakes, et cetera, et cetera. We have 10 PGE. Play or a dike model play in Nalunaq Valley, where our mine is. That's where we have more than 10 gram per ton palladium. We have 1% nickel, and we resampled that outcrop, and we did some geophysics over that. We have rare earths, various bits of rare earths. You should know that in South Greenland, one of the reasons why Trump wanted to acquire the country is that rare earths by, I think, the European Raw Material Alliance or something like that, they believe 10% of rare earths is situated in South Greenland, where we hold most of the license, all of the licenses there, or majority of the licenses there. Already are 3 deposits, which are all world-class deposits in South Greenland. So we're very much in dynamic mineral position where we are situated, where if you want to play South Greenland, you have to do it through us because we hold the land, right?
Yeah. I suppose one thing that's just dawned on me as well, Eldur, that obviously climate change and retreating glaciers is probably exposing a lot of outcrops and a lot of potential resources that were never, you know, that are completely virgin. They've never been touched by mankind before.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I can give you 2 examples of that. Like we own a license called Jochumshire, which is in northeast Greenland, where you have a zone that was once surrounded by 2 glaciers. And this zone has over, I think, 3 or 4 meters. It's a sulfide zone, we believe, of 10 gram per ton gold, like enormously high grade. And someone, I remember when we applied for it, I had a consultant said to me, this will never be mine. There are 2 glaciers around it. Well, I had calculated how quickly these glaciers are retreated. And I found out like within years, this wouldn't be closed off. And look and behold, now Jochumshire can be accessed from the fjord and there is no glacier around any longer. So they're retrieving 100 to 200 meters a year. Nørrearm, this big graphite deposit I told you about, it didn't exist 4 years ago. So we saw it on a satellite image. There was just a layer coming to surface very clearly, and now we can, this is what technology also help us, there's much better satellite imagery and so on. So we are finding a lot of these things when it comes to surface, which is, again, the glacier is like a giant shovel. It, you know, it takes all of the vegetation, everything off surface. And it also speaks to the point about when people say, where do you really want to mine in the world? Do you want to be mining in the middle of an Amazon forest, or is maybe an area where you're not having any interference with wildlife or vegetation? On the contrary, you can actually be building that up. I think that's where we want to be doing mining, in my view.
Yep, yep. No, it's definitely an exciting part of your journey. And obviously, I mean, I've looked at a presentation and I've looked at some of your results, etc. And you have this amazing war chest that's quite unusual for a... I'll call you a junior explorer, because I suppose really that's what you are. But I mean, you've got something like 20 million British pounds in the bank, which is unheard of for an explorer or developer.
No, yeah, certainly. So we have been fortunate enough to be well capitalized. We have a good policy in making sure that we maintain that benefit, and it gives us the optionality of choosing the best route and value creation for our shareholders. There are generally three ways to run these projects: is to use your own cash pile, which we will continue to do to increase value. But then, you know, you can obviously use the market, but you can also set yourself up for things like joint ventures and spin-outs, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a very good position to be in, to choose, well, have more say about your destiny rather than not being forced to go down a certain path. So we're very fortunate to be in that position.
Definitely. Mark, sorry, I've been talking too much. I maybe let you jump in.
No, you have. You've been talking a lot. Yeah, that's good. It's good. It's good to get a feel for what's going on. I think we spoke to Charlie the Geo from SI Capital, and he kind of suggested that Greenland could be Europe's answer to sort of Australia, as particularly for sourcing a lot of raw materials. And as you mentioned, it's an underexplored place, but you know, in the past has perhaps been a little bit hostile, but you know, there's a lot of strengths there. The government are supportive, and you've got the cash in the bank. You've got this great project. I mean, you mentioned before about the like a super cycle, and that's something that we hear occasionally. And there's different opinions as to whether we're going to see a super cycle in mining, or whether it's going to be more a sort of a super cycle in battery metals. What's your opinion on the super cycle, and perhaps how Greenland will or can play a part in that?
Yeah, so I mean, I just think I look at it very simplistically, because there are so many data points that people need to take into account when they're making predictions on any kind of demand and supply. I find that to be in this industry. So what I look at are the kind of the big picture. And the big picture before the financial crash in 07 and 08 was the fact that, you know, the population is growing. There's more and more people going from poverty to a middle class in the world, and hence you need more metals to allow that to happen, right? And therefore, to explore for this metal, you need to find a lot more, either in new areas or go deeper. There are two ways to do it. And that can be deeper in the ocean floor, or it can be deeper in the mines themselves. And going deeper is usually more expensive and more challenging rather than being on surface, right? So there is a element there. Then you have certain things that happen in between, which is more related to the cycle, like I mentioned earlier, where there's underinvestment into an industry like I'm working in for a long time, like 10 years. And if we put that into perspective of what is happening in this industry, is that on average around the world, it takes you 7 to 10 years to get a mine permitted. It takes you another at least 3 to 5 years to build it, right? If it's a proper size. And then you have to explore for it, which can take you 5 to 7. So you can see, if there is a demand and we are depleting the resources, it's not like something you change in a heartbeat, right? And that's why I think we're looking at a super cycle, not necessarily because the demand will pick up much from where it is today. It's because these minerals haven't been explored, and therefore it's like eating a cake. If you finish it, it's finished. You have to bake another one, right? It's not like a renewable. And it is essentially just follow the money, where the money has been going. And you can look at, I mentioned earlier, I mean, Facebook, all of these tech companies and so on, there's been no interest in investing in the mineral sector. And therefore, those minerals have been very low valued. Therefore, we're having very low inflation. And look and behold, soon as the mineral prices go up or any logistical constraints, the inflation goes right away up, right? And you're not going to change that by saying, oh, all of a sudden we're just going to mine it cheaper. No, it's just physically not possible because you have to work with your hands in this industry, not any way different. You can't computerize this or put it into a program, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not trying to criticize that. I'm just trying to give an example of how this industry works and how we need it. And therefore, I think there's a super cycle coming. I can't time it if it's happening in a 6 months or 1 year, but that direction is in that direction for sure, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I wonder if we maybe do just finish with the sort of 60-second challenge, which we occasionally spring on our guests. So I'm very sorry that you have no warning, but it might be a good idea to, if you're up for it, of course, we'll give you 60 seconds in order to sort of make the elevator pitch, if you like, for the company and the investment case. But I think as well, in your case, maybe for Greenland as well. So maybe half and half, you know, an investment case for Greenland and why people might consider AEX Gold. So, I mean, would you be up for that challenge, Eldur?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay. So what I'll do is I'll just get my stopwatch loaded up on my phone here, and I'll count you down from 3, 2, 1, take it away.
Right. I do think people should focus their eyes on Greenland for the key reason is that the minerals there on surface, you can go on the portal and find them. The jurisdiction is essentially Scandinavia. So you're working where the taxes are paid, where you have title rights, et cetera, et cetera. And you have a country that is big enough to have the potential of multi-million ounce resources. And that has been proven in the past 10 to 15, 20 years in the exploration in this area. So therefore, if you are looking at your investment, you cannot take only into account a drill intersection or something like that. You have to take everything into account, everything from the team to the jurisdiction to the resources to the area that you want to work in. And then you can even take politics into that as well. Where are you going to source it? What are the influences in that factor as well? And Greenland sits exactly where you should put your money in my view. And therefore, I put all of my capital so far that I have earned into Greenland because I think that's where the future lies.
Okay. Excellent. Well, you're a minute, 10 seconds there, but that was a good pitch for Greenland. So I think that covers pretty much everything, I think, does it, Kenny?
Yeah, it's been almost an hour and it's just flown in. So thanks very much for your time today, Eldur. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. And hopefully we'll catch up with you again in a few months. Mark, have you any final words?
No, that's great, except to say thank you very much, Eldur, for your time today. It's really given us an insight there into the company. And, of course, Greenland, so that might be another country I can add to my list to go and visit at some point.
Thank you, both.
Yep, happy to start.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fair Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.
Talking about money is hard. People all over the world were taught never to talk about money, politics, sex, or religion in polite company. But on this show, my goal is to remove money from that list. And so I'm excited to bring you 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning from Blind Nil Audio and executive producers Chip and Joanna Gaines. Follow and listen to 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning with me, Carl Richards, wherever you get your podcasts.